From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I want to make sure, if I do nothing else for the rest of this year, that those who've died in Iraq have not died in vain.
Michael Moore wins the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival for Fahrenheit 9/11, the film Disney doesn't want you to see. We'll hear his acceptance speech. We'll speak with FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds about why the Justice Department has retroactively classified public information it gave to Congress 2 years ago. Canada's top court rules in favor of the biotech giant Monsanto. We'll talk to the Canadian farmer who stood up to Monsanto on the landmark ruling. First, we'll speak with a former U.S. Marine, Jimmy Massey.
I'm a former staff sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, and I killed innocent civilians for our government.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 220 radio and television stations around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Crisis Group is warning 350,000 people may die in the Darfur region of the Sudan unless the world community helps avert a humanitarian crisis there. Over the past year, Arab militias backed by the Sudanese government have forced more than a million black Christian Africans to flee their homes. Tens of thousands of people have been killed in fighting. In one attack this weekend, villagers told Reuters Arab militias killed 56 people. Earlier this month, Human Rights Watch accused Sudan of committing ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity. Oxfam is warning food and fresh water levels are becoming dangerously low. In a recent article in the Boston Globe, the former National Security Advisor Anthony Lake wrote, quote, "In eerie similarity to 1994 Rwanda, the United Nations Security Council, not wanting to disrupt ongoing peace efforts, cannot even muster a statement of condemnation, while the Sudanese government flouts the already agreed ceasefire, delays at the negotiating table, starves the displaced, and continues to support its killer militias." This comes at a time that the Bush administration appears to be heading toward normalizing relations with the Sudanese government. Last week, Sudan was taken off the State Department's list of nations considered uncooperative in the so-called War on Terror. It remains on the list of sponsors of state terrorism. Tonight, President Bush plans to give a primetime televised address from the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania, outlining his vision for the future of Iraq, the so-called June 30th handover, and Iraqi elections. This speech comes just a day after four-star General Anthony Zinni, who was once in charge of all U.S. troops in the Middle East, appeared on 60 Minutes and scathingly criticized the administration's handling of Iraq. Zinni, the former commander-in-chief of the United States Central Command, said, quote, "At this stage, it should be evident to everybody that they've screwed up." He later added, quote, "To think that we're going to stay the course. The course is headed over Niagara Falls," he said. "I think it's time to change course a little bit, or at least hold somebody responsible for putting you on this course, because it's been a failure." Again, the words of Anthony Zinni, the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command. The Associated Press has released a videotape that appears to back up Iraqi claims that the U.S. bombed a wedding party last week, killing about 40 people. The U.S. has admitted to waging the attack, but denied that a wedding party was hit. However, the video appears to show before and after footage from the wedding, and some victims and survivors of the attack appear to be in the wedding video. In Fallujah, two U.S. soldiers died Sunday, bringing the total U.S. death toll to nearly 800. The total number of Iraqis killed is not known, but it's at least 11,000. A new survey by the Associated Press found 5,500 Iraqis died violently in Baghdad and in the provinces of Karbala, Kirkuk, and Tikrit in the first year of the U.S. occupation. In the Shiite holy city of Kufa, U.S. forces raided a mosque over the weekend, killing 32 Iraqis loyal to the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Newsday is reporting the Defense Intelligence Agency has concluded that the U.S.-funded Iraqi National Congress, led by Ahmed Chalabi, has used for years by the Iranian intelligence to pass disinformation to the United States. One intelligence source told Newsday, quote, Iranian intelligence has been manipulating the United States through Chalabi by furnishing through his information collection program information to provoke the United States into getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Patrick Lang, the former head of DIA operations in the Middle East, described what Iran did as, quote, one of the most sophisticated and successful intelligence operations in history. The U.S. government's also reportedly intensifying its investigation into how the INC leader Ahmed Chalabi managed to obtain highly classified Pentagon and CIA material and then pass it on to Iran. According to the New York Times, federal espionage statutes prohibit anyone from knowingly passing classified information to a foreign power, even though in this case the United States has supported Chalabi. While Chalabi denies the charge, he admitted on CNN Sunday that in December he met with the Iranian Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the Iranian President, Mohammad Khatami, as well as the Iranian Minister of Information. Meanwhile, Times reporting that the ex-intelligence chief for Chalabi, who has been accused of being an Iranian agent, has relocated to Tehran. Chalabi was also the prime source for several of the New York Times exposés on Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction. Last year, the New York Times reporter Judith Miller sent an email to her colleague John Burns that read, quote, I've been covering Chalabi for about 10 years and have done most of the stories about him for our paper. He has provided most of the front page exclusives on WMD to our paper, unquote. The trade journal editor and publisher noted last week the Times has yet to run any corrections on Miller's reporting. The New York Times is reporting a military intelligence unit that oversaw interrogations at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq was also in charge of questioning at the Bagram Detention Center in Afghanistan, where two prisoners died in December 2002 from the blunt force injuries to their legs. Two former detainees who served time at Bagram told the New York Times they were physically tortured and sexually humiliated by U.S. jailers. At times, their hands were chained to the ceiling while black hoods were placed over their heads. In related news, the Los Angeles Times is reporting two military intelligence officers who appeared in some of the photos taken at Abu Ghraib have been ordered not to leave Iraq as the U.S. investigates the reports of abuse. Meanwhile, the lawyer for one of the soldiers facing court-martial for his role in the prison torture said his U.S. client will testify that the commander of U.S. troops in Iraq, Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, either witnessed some of the abuse taking place or personally heard about the abuse allegations. The military has denied that this is true. Staff Sergeant Camilla Mejia was sentenced to 1 year in prison Friday after a military jury convicted him on charges of desertion after he refused to return to fight in Iraq. Mejia returned from Iraq in October on leave and then went into hiding. He gave himself up in March, announcing he didn't want to fight in an oil-driven war. He also said he witnessed the torture and abuse of Iraqi prisoners at another detention facility outside Abu Ghraib. You can go to our website at democracynow.org and hear the conversation we had with Camilo Mejia's aunt as she was getting into Fort Stewart to attend the court-martial proceedings of her nephew. in Israel. The country's justice minister said Sunday Israel's army demolition of Palestinian homes in the Gaza Strip reminds him of the actions the Nazis took against his family during World War II. The minister said seeing a picture of a Palestinian woman by the rubble of her old home reminded him, quote, of my grandmother in the Holocaust. On Saturday, India swore in its first non-Hindu prime minister, Manmohan Singh, who is sick. Singh is leading the Congress Party, which defeated the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP party in elections 2 weeks ago. In New York City, more than 1,700 police officers and firefighters have filed lawsuits against the city claiming they got sick from working at Ground Zero and the Fresh Kills landfill, where 2 million tons of debris have been taken to the landfill after the September 11th attacks. According to the Daily News, workers have reported suffering from permanent lung conditions, asthma, chronic coughs, and having glass lodged in their lung tissue. More than 300 firefighters have already retired with disabilities related to injuries or illnesses suffered at Ground Zero. And at the Cannes Film Festival, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 became the first documentary in nearly 50 years to take the festival's coveted top prize, the Palme d'Or. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. The U.S. Army is denying reports that the highest-ranking American officer in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, was present during some of the interrogations and prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib outside of Baghdad. This follows a report in the Washington Post over the weekend about an April 2nd military hearing on prisoner torture allegations. According to the Post, a lawyer representing one of the accused soldiers said the commander of the U.S. military police company at the center of the abuse scandal, Donald Reese, told him that General Sanchez was aware of what was taking place. Tonight, President Bush will deliver a primetime address on Iraq, aimed in part at controlling the damage from the situation at Abu Ghraib. Meanwhile, conscientious objector Sergeant Camilo Mejia was sentenced to a year in prison for deserting the Army. His application for CO status mentioned prisoner abuse in Iraq long before the current scandal, and he has offered to testify before Congress about it. Now another U.S. soldier who participated in the invasion of Iraq as well as the occupation has begun speaking out. 12-year Marine veteran Jimmy Massey joins us on the line from North Carolina. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very good. Can you talk about when you were in Iraq?
I was part of the initial invading force. I was part of 1st Marine Division, categorized into RCT-7. The battalion that I was with was 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, Weapons Company, Cat 1. I was basically in the main invasion all the way up into Baghdad. And then once Baghdad fell, my battalion headed south towards the city of Karbala.
And can you talk about your experience there?
Generally, what led up to my disgust with the war was the the civilian casualties that we were inflicting. We were given intelligence reports. The civilian casualties really started taking place after we left the town of Banu Minya on the drive north towards Baghdad. We were getting intelligence reports from higher command saying that the Fedayeen and the Republican Guard were trading in their uniforms for civilian clothes, and they were mounting terrorist attacks against U.S. soldiers and Marines using guerrilla-style tactics, suicide bombings. They were using civilians as human shields. They were loading down stolen ambulances and police cars with explosives. So as we progressed on towards Baghdad, our fears and anxieties were heightened, and also due, you know, to the lack of sleep. Some of us had less than 48 hours of sleep getting into Baghdad. So whenever we were placed into these situations where civilian vehicles were coming up to our checkpoints and not heeding our warning shot, we were lighting them up. And what I mean by lighting them up, we were discharging our weapons, 50 cals and M16s, into the civilian vehicles. Now, when we would do this, we were expecting, you know, secondary explosions, ammunition to be, you know, cooking off, or actually have the occupants in the vehicle fire back at us. However, none of this ever happened. And when we would go to search the vehicles, we would find no weapons and nothing to link these individuals with terrorist acts. And this happened continuously through the fall of Baghdad. I would say my platoon alone killed 30-plus innocent civilians.
How would you realize what you had done? Can you give a specific example of a
car? Sure. A car would roll up to our checkpoint, and prior, while we were still in Kuwait, we had actually made up Arabic signs, road signs, to place out in front of our checkpoint area, warning the Iraqis to slow down. That didn't help. We would verbally tell them stop, and we would fire a warning shot. When we would light the cars up, you know, we would go through and search the dead occupants as well as the vehicles, and we would find nothing that directly linked them to any type of terrorist. They were just average civilians that were trying to flee out of Iraq, out of Baghdad, out of the city limits, because of, you know, the invading American force. They were scared. But with the intelligence reports that we were given, it was very hard for us to distinguish the good guys from the bad guys. We ultimately started looking at everybody in Iraq as a potential suicide bomber or terrorist, from women to children to old men. We didn't know who the enemy was.
We're talking to Jimmy Massey, former Marine Staff Sergeant, honorably discharged in December after serving 12 years, most recently in Iraq. He was in charge of a platoon that consisted of machine gunners and missile men, describing, quote, lighting up cars, opening fire on Iraqi cars. When you would go up to the cars and see who was dead inside, what would you do with the bodies?
We would take the bodies and we would search them to try to find any type of identification or anything like that. If generally we found large quantities of cash, and that's what led us to believe that these people were just fleeing out of Baghdad. They were trying to, you know, secure what valuables that they had. Some of them had their valuables in the car, but you know, there was basically nothing that we could do with the bodies other than toss them in the ditch and off the road. So that's what we would do, and then hopefully wait for the Iraqi medics to civilian medics to come in and take care of the bodies.
How many children would you estimate you killed?
With unknown gunfire, the potential was unlimited. And what I mean by unknown, you know, gunfire, whenever you fire a machine gun, especially a 50 caliber or any type of lightweight machine gun, you don't know where the bullets are going to go. So, you know, bullets could indiscriminately hit a child. The architecture in some of these villages that we went into were very shady construction, that and our weapons could easily punch through. And the reason I say that or use that as an example, I had a young child die in my arms. The father came up to us at the checkpoint with the child and began to say, the bombs killed his child. I called the corpsman. The corpsman came over and assessed the child and said the child probably had internal damage from the concussion from the bombs. So as this child died in my arms, you know, I began to think, you know, wow, here's an innocent child that was just sleeping or, you know, doing things that children do. And the response that I got from my command was, well, better them than us. And, you know, he's just a casualty of war. Sorry. However, that father that was standing there as his child was dying in my arms, and, you know, the doc was resuscitating, doing CPR, you know, this father was looking at me like, why did you do this? You know, and, you know, why does my son have to die? Almost just like a hatred look towards me. He knew that I was obviously in command. And another incident, it was on the outskirts of Baghdad, near the Baghdad Stadium. We had pulled into an area, and shortly after we had pulled in, it was on a major highway, like a super highway going in towards Baghdad. We had just lit up a vehicle, a red Kia, the Korean-made passenger vehicle. And we had just lit it up. They failed to stop at our checkpoint. Three of the men were fatally wounded that was in the vehicle, and one, the driver, had survived without any damage. As we were pulling the bodies out of the vehicle, of course, we're searching and we find nothing. These were young men. They were in their mid-20s. The one that was unscathed, he looked up at me and he goes, you know, why did you kill my brother? We didn't do anything to you. We're not terrorists. And so I have three dying men with bullet holes from, you know, our weapons, and this gentleman asking me why I killed his brother. That's a tough pill to swallow. And that continuously happened the entire time that we were in Iraq. After we left the city of Enumania, it just became utter chaos. It sickened me so that I had actually brought it up to my lieutenant, and I told him, I said, you know, sir, we're not going to have to worry about the Iraqis. You know, we're basically committing genocide over here, you know, mass extermination of thousands of Iraqis. And with the depleted uranium that we're leaving around on the battlefield, you know, we're setting up genocide for future generations within Iraq. He didn't like that. He immediately went to my commanding officer, Captain Schmidt, and proceeded to tell him about how I felt about Iraq. Word spread pretty quickly, and I knew that my Marine Corps career was over. I knew that the statement that I had just made was going to bring about the black ball pretty quickly. So I was scurried out of Iraq quickly in order to report back stateside to receive psychological therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression. When I got back stateside, that's when things really became ugly. I felt like the staff sergeant that just received the prison sentence for a year. I had to hire a lawyer because they were trying to pin me with a conscientious objector. And basically, they were doing everything in their power to threaten me and to intimidate me so that I would go UA. Unfortunately, with the staff sergeant, he fell into their trap, and he went UA. So,
what does UA mean?
Unauthorized absence. That means that he left without authorization, and that's basically, you know, that's what they charged him with. And then they later on pinned on the conscientious objector. However, the Marine Corps told me that they were going to bring legal repercussions against me, and I decided to hire a lawyer. The lawyer that I hired was actually, he was involved with the May Lai trials. So I got really lucky. A man by the name of Gary Myers in Washington, D.C. Their main concern was whether or not I was a conscientious objector. I told them that I believe in war, and some wars in our history have been helpful for humanity and society as a whole. However, I do not believe in killing innocent civilians. So I told them that if they wanted to label me as a conscientious objector for disagreeing with killing innocent civilians, then I'll see him in court.
We're talking to Jimmy Massey, former staff sergeant, Marine, honorably discharged in December after serving 12 years. We're speaking to him from his home in Waynesville, North Carolina, in the Smoky Mountains. We'll come back to him in a minute.
Skies go. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Mercy. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and
this is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey, honorably discharged in December, talking about his experiences in Iraq. You talk about opening fire on a group of protesters.
Yes.
Can you describe it?
Sure. We had just rolled up. It was probably about 20 miles north of the Saddam International Airport. We had rolled up into this military compound area. And to try to give you, it's a little bit important that you understand the architecture. This military compound was heavily fortified with about 13-foot-tall concrete fences going all the way around the compound. This particular road that we went into, these walls were on the left and right, and the road itself was about 1,000 meters long. So it made it very difficult, and it was a prime area for an ambush. When we pulled up, there was already a Abrams tank, a U.S. Marine Abrams tank, that was parked into one of the entrances to the military compound. And at the end of the street, about 200 meters away from the tank, there was a group of demonstrators. They were holding a peaceful demonstration. They were holding up signs what looked like a Muslim cleric, as well as Saddam Hussein. The intelligence that we received was these demonstrators, there was about four of them, and there was 10 in the background. They were standing next to a highway overpass. The intelligence that we had gotten, these people were probably members of the Iraqi military that had slipped back into the community, and they were going to be waging all these terrorist attacks against us. We rolled up, and about 2 minutes later, we had heard a stray gunfire, and my men were already on the edge, you know, with anxiety and the lack of sleep and with the constant reports that we were given. When the gunshot was fired, my Marines opened up on the demonstrators. I turned around just in time because I was walking the lines inspecting my Marines to make sure that they had food and water and they were in the right position in case of an ambush. I turned around to the front of the convoy and I saw my Marines opening up. I swung my rifle around. I didn't know what was going on, and I started discharging my weapon as well into the demonstrators. After that, the lieutenant decided to go on a reconnaissance up onto the overpass area. As we were driving towards the demonstrators, I didn't see any weapons, which just horrified me at the thought that you know, we just opened up on a group of peaceful demonstrators. However, we heard gunshots coming from that direction towards us. So as we rolled up onto the highway overpass, I looked down, and below the highway, it looked like the Iraqis had set up some sort of makeshift military compound, but it had been abandoned. I saw some RPGs lining up against the wall underneath this highway, and they were about 200 meters away from the Iraqi demonstrators. And this really disturbed me because the demonstrators, if they wanted to fire on us, they had the ability. They had the ability before we even got there to destroy this tank. Because the way that we were jammed into this area, it was almost impossible for us to turn around quickly. And nearly, or double almost, you know, impossible for this tank to fire or use its main battle gun. It basically left this tank defenseless. So these Iraqis had a clear shot of this tank before we even got there, but they didn't. I put two and two together and said, oh, my God, we just opened up on a group of peaceful demonstrators.
We're talking to former Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey. What about the use of cluster bombs?
I had a staff sergeant at the very beginning of the war. He was our supply staff sergeant. He lost his leg because of cluster bombs. Cluster bombs were everywhere, and I believe that he was the first Marine to be awarded the Purple Heart in Operation Iraq, because it happened in Safwan, the town of Safwan. Which is the very first city as you're heading from Kuwait into Iraq. They were everywhere. And just the long-term casualties of these cluster bombs, you know, with children and, you know, older people working in the fields, is going to go on for years.
And where were they from?
From Marine artillery. And from air.
In the case of the protests, when you realized you'd open fire on defenseless civilians, what was the reaction of your troops, and how many people felt the way you did?
The reaction of the troops was they were joyous. You know, it's not their job to play politics. That's the job of the staff sergeant and the lieutenant, to make determinations on whether or not we were in the right or we were in the wrong. I didn't tell my troops, because my job is to keep them motivated so that they go home alive and in one piece and left with some sort of sanity after the war. However, I did have several of my younger troops come up to me in private and say, you know, Staff Sergeant, can I talk to you? And then they would go on to tell me, you know, that some of the incidences were affecting them. So I told them, I said, listen, Devil Dog, you know, we're here to do a job, and we're here to provide democracy for the Iraqis. And you questioning and you playing politician is not helping them. So I want you to get back out there on the gun line and do your job as a Marine and let the politicians do their job. But deep down, it was seriously affecting me because it was so evident. You know, Marines are trained from day one that you go in, when you go into boot camp, on what the Geneva Convention is, what the rules of the Geneva Convention. What's the rules, or, you know, the rules of engagement? However, Iraq violated every rule of engagement that I've ever been taught, violated every rule of the Geneva Convention that I've been taught. And if you have young Marines coming up to you and asking you, Staff Sergeant, what's going on? You know, we've got a problem.
What are you doing right now? How are you living with yourself? How are you dealing with what happened in Iraq, with what you and your soldiers did in Iraq?
I'll be honest with you, there isn't a waking moment of the day that I don't think about it and think about what we've done over there. A lot of people ask me, you know, why are you speaking out? Why are you... you know, are you just trying to do this for money, fame, fortune? You know, what are you doing? I've been called a traitor, a disloyal, SOB, you name it. The reason that I'm doing this is to heal myself and to possibly heal other Marines that are not in the position for them to come out and say something because of fear from retaliation from the Marine Corps. I'm doing this to not only to heal myself, but to help other Marines that feel the same way that I do.
And so are others talking to you now here?
No. Let me explain to you. I was also a recruiter for 3 years in the Marine Corps. Whenever you sign up for the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, you have a 4-year commitment. At the end of that 4-year commitment, you still have another 4-year commitment in what's called an IRR, Individual Ready Reserve. That means in the time of national emergency or crisis, the President of the United States can call these members back to active duty. So these Marines that have been discharged, you know, after the fall of Iraq, they're living back in their civilian community, but they're still fearful to come out and say anything because the Marine Corps can call them back to active duty. And then they're worried about what happened to the staff sergeant. The staff sergeant is being used as a patsy. He's being used as, see, this is what will happen to you if you speak out. However, I spent 12 years in. There's nothing that they can do to me as far as calling me back to active duty. So I feel it's my responsibility to let the civilian public know. You know, the bullets that we put into those civilians were paid for by the U.S. tax dollars. I believe that the U.S. taxpayers have a right to know what's going on over there. When we pulled into that military compound, they had makeshift morgues. They had tractor trailer beds full of bodies. It was so bad, and this was because of the bombing that we did. Some of them had Iraqi flags on them representing that they were a soldier, but 80% of them didn't. We would find tractor trailers literally full of stacked bodies. It was so bad that the plasma from the body and the skin was decomposing and literally oozing out of the crevices of the tractor trailer bed. And we asked some of the Iraqis, the locals that were, you know, basically homeless and they were living in the compound. We asked them, we were like, you know, what is this? How come, the bodies are in there? And he told us it was from the bombing. And when they lost the power, they didn't have any other place to put them. So they put them in there to bury them later on.
Jimmy Massey, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former Marine Staff Sergeant, honorably discharged in December after serving 12 years, speaking to us from his home in Waynesville, North Carolina, in the Smoky Mountains. Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I'd just like to say to the Marines, you did a great job. You did what your country asked you to do. Unfortunately, the rules of engagement and the Geneva Convention weren't used. But it's up to you to look within your heart and do the right thing. You know who you are. Don't be scared. Come out. The American public, they need to know. You're not the only one. There are other people out there that can help you to heal. There's other people out there that can help you to get on with your life. Don't feel ashamed. Don't feel embarrassed. You did a great job. However, you know, the command, they didn't give you the right tools for you to carry on with your mission. Just do the right thing, Marines.
Who do you hold most responsible for this?
The President of the United States. He's the one that authorized it. He's the one that said that we had weapons of mass destruction. He's the one that gave the case for us to go into war. We went to war backing him. However, the intelligence reports that we were getting hindered our ability to make Iraq a free democracy. You know, it's hard to tell a young man in his 20s, say 20 to 28 years old, that just watched his brother die by the hands of Americans. It's hard to tell him, you know what, hey, we're sorry. All right? He's just a casualty of war. Now, this young man has taken revenge or is acting revenge against the United States in Fallujah, in Karbala. He's picking up that RPG because he's mad. He's mad at the Americans. We were supposed to go in there and set up a democracy. All we did was cause chaos and have a genocidal mindset, you know, a genocide mindset. So they're mad, and they have every right to be mad. I know somebody killed my brother, you know, indiscriminately, and then laughed about it and said, well, sorry, wrong place, wrong time. I would be mad too.
Jimmy Massey, thank you for being with us, former Marine Staff Sergeant, speaking to us from North Carolina.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Michael Moore has won the highest prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And when he accepted the Palme d'Or, he said, I want to make sure, if I do nothing else for the rest of this year, that those that have died in Iraq have not died in vain. Stay with us.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation, in the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. Down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb
Michael Franti, Bomb the World, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11, has won the Palme d'Or, the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival in France, the first documentary to win the honor in almost 50 years. After receiving the award from actress Charlize Theron, Moore delivered his acceptance speech.
You have to understand, the last time I was on an awards stage in Hollywood, all hell broke loose. So I can't begin to express my appreciation and my gratitude for this to the jury, to the festival, to Gilles Jacob and Thierry Fromo, to Bob and Harvey and Agnès at Miramax, to all of the crew who worked on this film. It's been a rough few weeks because we lost our American distributor. But I'm happy to announce that we have a distributor now in Albania. we just were told. So now every country in the world can see this film, except one. And I have a sneaking suspicion, thanks to what you have done here and the response from everyone at this festival, you will ensure that the American people will see this movie. I can't thank you enough for that. You've put a huge light on this, and many people want the truth to be put away, to be put in the closet, and you've taken it out of the closet by this act. And there was a great Republican president in America who once said that if you just give the people the truth, the republic will be safe. That was Abraham Lincoln, a different kind of Republican. I was back home in the United States yesterday at my daughter's graduation. She graduated from college. She got her master's degree at the age of 22. And we got some hurried call last night that maybe we should come back, but there was no guarantee of anything, and so we rushed back here. I would like to dedicate this award tonight to my daughter and to all the children in America and in Iraq and throughout the world who suffer as a result of our actions. I believe, and I have this this great hope, that things are going to change. I'm confident of that. I'm not alone. There are millions of Americans just like me. And I'm just like them. And that, I hope, gives the world some hope. I want to make sure, if I do nothing else for the rest of this year, that those who've died in Iraq have not died in vain. I want to make sure that that happens. And I thank you again for this incredible honor as one who has always loved going to the movies. And all I've ever wanted to do was make a movie that me and my buddies could go to on a Friday night and just eat some popcorn and enjoy the films. Giving me this honor tonight is the best thing that could happen to one who loves this art form so much. And thank you for that. And thank all of you very much.
Michael Moore, receiving the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival this weekend. First time in almost 50 years a documentary had won. He won it for Fahrenheit 9/11, the film that Disney is forbidding its subsidiary Miramax from distributing. When Michael Moore received the award, he referred to his receiving the Academy Award, the Oscar, for Bowling for Columbine, and what happened the last time he got up on a stage to receive an award. This was that moment at the Academy Awards.
On behalf of our producers, Kathleen Glynn and Michael Donovan from Canada, I'd like to thank the Academy for this. I've invited my fellow documentary nominees on the stage with us. And we would like to, they are here in solidarity with me because we like nonfiction. We like nonfiction and we live in fictitious times. We live in a time where we have fictitious election results that elects a fictitious president. We live in a time where we have a man sending us to war for fictitious reasons, whether it's the fictitious of duct tape or the fictitious of orange alerts. We are against this war, Mr. Bush. Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you. And anytime you've got the Pope and the Dixie Chicks against you, your time is up. Thank you very much.
That was Michael Moore receiving the Academy Award for Bowling for Columbine a year before this new prize, the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. The jury gave Moore the award this year, also considered giving a special prize to President Bush for Best Comic Performance in a Movie. That was revealed Sunday by British actress Tilda Swinton, who was one of the 9 jury members. We're going to go back right now to an interview we did with Michael Moore when he just came out with Dude, Where's My Country? Fahrenheit 9/11 deals with a number of issues, the brutality in Iraq right now, soldiers dying and actually showing the images. As well, it deals with the Bush family relationship with the Saudi royal family. In Dude, Where's My Country?, he talks about the 7 questions that he had for President Bush. Among them, what was he thinking when he continued reading to the children in a Florida classroom after he had learned that 2 planes had flown into both towers of the World Trade Center? But he begins on the issue of Saudi Arabia.
Well, my first question is, I'd like to know from Mr. Bush what exactly is the business relationship over the last 25 years between the Bushes and the Bin Ladens? I was really stunned the first time I read about this, that the person who handles the Bin Laden's money in Texas back in the late 70s was also the person who was an investor in Arbusto, one of Bush's first little ventures that his dad set him up with. And it was so astounding to see that potentially, you know, there was Bin Laden money involved with the Bush family. And this goes back to the 70s. Now jump all the way to the Carlyle Group, where you have Bin Laden's investing in the Carlyle Group. This is where George Sr., this group, that, you know, the company that he's involved with. When George Sr. goes to Saudi Arabia, he'd stay, you know, the Bin Ladens are all friends with each other. And it's like, well, what are the chances of that? Of the 6 billion people on the planet, you know, that the guy supposedly responsible for the worst terrorist act on our soil, also his family just happens to, you know quite well and have business relations with the first family of this country. I mean, it's like, and why won't the press ask this question? Maybe it means nothing. Maybe it's just a coincidence that their paths seem to cross in these ways, and maybe it isn't. I mean, I'd like to know that. I think the American people have a right to know. And I say in the book, if after Oklahoma City it had been revealed that Timothy McVeigh's family had been involved in business relationships with the Clintons for 25 years, what do you think the press would have done with that? What do you think the Republicans would have done with that? I mean, they would have gone nuts, you know? And yet, when it's the Bushes and the Bin Ladens, nobody asked the question. Question number 2 to Bush. What is the relationship between your family and the Saudi royal family? Where are those 28 pages? Why don't we know, you know, I'm talking about the congressional report of 9/11. What are you protecting here? I think we have a right to know what exactly is this relationship. And I talk about the scene here in the book where 2 nights after 9/11 on September 13th, he's got Prince Bandar, the ambassador in Saudi Arabia, out on the Truman balcony. They're sharing a cigar, looking out over Washington while things are still smoldering here in New York City, he and they have such a close relationship that the Saudi royal family refers to his dad as Bandar Bush. They've actually given him his own, you know, nickname within the royal family. And this is how close they are, and a lot of this goes to a gut feeling on my part, and it's nothing more than this. But again, you know, you wish that investigative journalists or somebody in Congress would start asking these questions: was this really a terrorist attack on September 11th, or was it a military attack? Why is it always called a terrorist attack? Why isn't it called a military attack? Because it sure looked like a military attack to me. If you know anything about flying a plane, if you're going 586 miles an hour, you know, the World Trade Center, those buildings were like a block wide. That's not very, I mean, if you're off by a centimeter, you know, that plane is in the East River. To hit it that directly, to do it twice, these people knew what they were doing, and they did not learn how to do that. It's a flight training school in Florida on a video game. They did not learn how to do that there. And I think some questions need to be asked about what involvement did the Saudi military possibly have in either training these people? Were these rogue elements within the Saudi royal family or within the Saudi military? You know, we already know there's huge divisions within the royal family about how the country should be run. It's in total chaos over there. The king has, you know, had a stroke, and he's not really been running the country now for a number of years. I don't have all the answers here, but I'm asking these questions because I think somebody should answer them. And I go through, and there's, you know, more in the about why the bin Ladens were allowed to fly.
We'll go into that, because each of these things, and now you being immersed in the book and having done research for the last few years, you are now taking them for granted. What is so astounding is most people in this country do not know this, don't know about when the grounding of the air traffic happened in this country right after September 11th. What happened?
And I think if you explain this to the average American out there, that after all the planes were grounded and none of us could fly, and my wife and I know this very specifically because we were stuck out in L.A. We were supposed to fly that day back here, and we had to get in a car, and we drove 3,000 miles. So nobody could fly. I mean, nobody. All planes were grounded for two, three, actually up to 4 days. Right away, the Bush administration gave permission for private Saudi jets to be allowed to fly around America and pick up 24 members and associates of the bin Laden family in four or five cities and fly them to Boston, where they then got together, and then after a few more days were then flown out of the country to Paris without any kind of investigation by the FBI or real interrogation. Not only that, according to the Times last month, there's now up to 150, 160 members of the royal family and other Saudi officials who were in the country at the time who also got free plane rides and picked up and taken out of the country when no one else could fly. So no one could fly in America on September 12th or 13th unless your name was bin Laden. I mean, just stop and think about that for just a few seconds. And I don't mean to implicate, I'm not saying that just because your name is bin Laden, you're automatically guilty of something. It's not what I'm saying. But common sense will tell anyone that, if your brother has just been accused of committing the worst mass murder in American history, would it be wrong for the police maybe to come and ask you a few questions? Not that you had anything to do with it, but just, do you have any idea where he is? If he calls, could you let us know?
Michael Moore, he is the recipient now of the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, the Palme d'Or, the first time in almost 50 years for his film Fahrenheit 9/11. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hupto Kudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Mike DeFlippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.